This is courage to resist, bringing you the voices of the troops who refused to fight. Today, we're speaking with the first Iraq War veteran to seek refugee status in Europe. Andre Shepard served as a helicopter mechanic in the U.S. Army in Iraq, and while he was there, he began to have serious doubts about the U.S. occupation of that country. In 2007, rather than return to Iraq to participate in a war he no longer believed in, he went AWOL from his base in Ansbach, Germany. On November 26, 2008, Andre applied to the German government for political asylum, asserting that the war in Iraq has been declared illegal by the German government. Andre is on the phone with us today from his home in Germany. Andre, thanks for speaking with Courage to Resist.
Hey, no problem.
It's good to hear your voice. Before we talk about what's going on with you right now, let's get some background. Tell us first, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
And went to school in Cleveland?
Correct. And I went to college at Kent State University as well.
And when were you at Kent State?
I was there from the fall of 1995 till the spring of 2000.
So you left Kent State in the year 2000. What did you do after that?
Well, the problem was that was when the dot-com bubble burst. So while I was trying to search for a job in the computer sciences, which I went to school for, I couldn't get a job because the requirements changed to where you must have a master's degree or at least 5 years of experience in the field. So I wasn't able to put my foot through the door at the entry level there. So what I ended up doing was working in several jobs with, you know, like in fast food, worked as a courier, like a vacuum cleaner salesman for a little bit, stuff in envelopes, things like that, you know, just pretty much like low-paying jobs, just trying to make ends meet.
So with your college diploma in hand, the only work you could find was in very low-paying jobs. That must have been very discouraging for you.
Yes, it was. I mean, mentally, I felt like that not only have I let myself down, but I let my family down, too, because I had a set goal in life, and I wanted to, you know, complete college, have a house, you know, have a family and everything, and to actually do something that would, A, make the world at least a little bit better place, and B, for, you know, to show that my parents that, you know, I can live life on my own and everything. And since it didn't work out that way, that was pretty distressing.
I can imagine that it was. So what did you do?
So what happened was that's when my life started, you know, going through two distinct phases. Well, one, I ended up living in my car, and once in 2001 for about 6 months, and second time in 2003 for about the same period of time. In about the summer of 2003, I ran into an Army recruiter in Lakewood, Ohio, and he was telling me about, you know, the engagements that they were in and everything, and how, you know, they needed people like me to, you know, help the people of the world free themselves from, you know, terrorism and dictators and things like that. For example, he used Saddam Hussein, Osama bin Laden, Kim Jong-il, you know, the poster children for the axis of evil. So he talked to me a little bit about that. Then he started talking about the Army benefits, you know, the steady pay, ability to travel, free medical care, free housing, even that would continue even, you know, after I left the service. All I had to do was sign up for a few years and, you know, I would have all of these benefits and everything. At the time, you know, I was, you know, living in my car, so that sounded really appealing. So after a few months of debating whether or not it was a good idea, I decided to join the service on the 27th of January in 2004.
2004. So the war in Iraq was raging, and it had been going on for nearly a year by that time.
Correct.
We often hear people speak about the so-called poverty draft, an economic system that forces many people to join the military as a way to escape poverty. Sounds like you were one of those poverty draftees. So you joined in January of 2004. Did you want to be a combat soldier?
Well, I knew that since, you know, we were engaged in warfare, you know, with the war on terror going on and everything, that it would be, you know, an eventuality. And at that time, I didn't have the knowledge that I have now. So all I had was pretty much what the mass media was telling me and what the Bush administration was saying, you know, on the mass media. And at that time, I still had, you know, trust in my government and everything that, you know, they would actually tell us the truth as to what's going on. So it didn't bother me to go into warfare at all. I thought that I would be doing, you know, a great service to my country, and in the long run, I could, you know, actually put my life on the right path.
And where did you go to basic training?
Basic training was held at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. We were there for 9 weeks. And then after that, I went to Fort Eustis so I could learn AIT for the Apache helicopter repair.
And after AIT, where were you assigned?
I was permanently assigned to Tatterbach Army Airfield, located in Ansbach, Germany.
Ansbach, Germany. Germany is a jumping-off point for a lot of troops going to Iraq, right? And is that what happened to you?
Yes, that's correct. The unit that was there, the 601st Aviation Support Battalion, was already deployed for 6 months by the time I got there. So then once I got there, I was reassigned to join them at Camp Spiker, which is outside of Tikrit in Iraq, and joined the unit there.
And how long were you in Iraq?
I was there from September 2004 till about the beginning of February of 2005.
So tell me about some of what you experienced when you were there.
Okay, my experience is obviously completely different than what of the military. You know, how they're always out on patrol and everything, kicking down doors and stuff. Our main mission there was to make sure that the Apache helicopter continued to fly. Because, you know, without proper maintenance and everything, the birds can't get off the ground. So we were working 12-hour days, 6 days a week, you know, maintaining the helicopters. Sometimes we would be on duty, you know, watching the local population come inside and, you know, help us build defenses, you know, like sandbag defenses and everything to fortify our hooches, which is where our living areas were. And sometimes we would be on guard duty.
So while you were there, something must have happened because you said when you joined up, you believed everything the media told you. You believed in your government. You supported the mission in Iraq. What changed?
Okay. Now, this one is a story that will take about 2 years. The beginnings of that was while I was in Iraq. The first thing that I noticed was that, you know, when the local population would come onto our post and everything, and usually when you liberate, you know, a people and everything, they're usually overjoyed to see you. They're happy, you know, that you want to help them and everything, and they welcome you with open arms. When I would see the Iraqi population, you know, in the mornings when I was on my way to work and everything, they didn't look like, you know, they were any way near happy to see us. I mean, they looked like either, one, they were afraid of me, like I was going to, like, you know, hurt them in any kind of way, or B, that, you know, if I turned my back without my weapon, they would probably want to kill me. So that started me thinking, like, okay, you know, what's going on here? Because, you know, I thought that we were supposed to be the good guys and everything. Why is everybody, you know, looking at me like I'm crazy? And then I started talking to the soldiers, you know, on the base and everything, you know, trying to get to know everybody since they were already down there for a half a year. And a lot of the things that they were talking about was that they didn't understand as to why, you know, they were there. And for me, this is a really big problem because I'm the type of person that, you know, has to have a clear plan as to what's going on so I can effectively do my job, especially, you know, if you're going to be in a combat zone, you know. And it didn't make any sense to me that, you know, the soldiers didn't, you know, see any type of benefit as to why, you know, why we were there and, you know, what our mission was to accomplish and everything. So that started me thinking about, you know, well, maybe, you know, we might have actually made a mistake because I started wondering, okay, why are we here? Because, you know, we're half a world away, you know, the way it's looking is that, you know, from, you know, what I've seen of the people and everything, that the people pose, like, no threat to the mainland United States, and something, you know, definitely didn't seem, some things didn't seem to make any sense. So what I started to do, research, you know, while I was on the post and everything, just to see, and I started seeing little inconsistencies, you know, from what the Bush administration was telling everybody as to, you know, what was actually happening, especially, you know, in the run-up to the Iraq war. Because our media, you know, tends to shield the population from, you know, any type of dissident, you know, dissidents from the official line. What I started seeing was, like, major countries like France and Germany and everybody was, like, staunchly against the war, how the UN was trying to, you know, let the weapons inspectors, you know, do their job and everything so they can, you know, so they can work out the problem without having any armed conflict and anything, and how the Bush administration was trying to ram things through. And that started to bother me because it looked to me that there was some type of other agenda going on besides, you know, trying to, you know, free the Iraq people from a dictator or, you know, trying to find weapons of mass destruction, which was also reported, you know, that they were never found. The other thing that happened there was, you know, with the Battle of Fallujah, where they were saying that's like a really great victory, you know, for us in Iraq and everything, and, you know, the soldiers were all happy and everything, the way it was portrayed to us on the military channel, that, you know, that we had done a great thing, like, you know, lifted a city that was completely, like, overrun by terrorists and and insurgents and things. And but then when I was continuing my research, I was seeing some really appalling things about, like, men that were, like, a fighting age, even if they weren't even, like, you know, wanting to fight or anything, they weren't allowed to leave the city, so that basically they were just sitting there defenseless, you know, caught in the siege, you know, of the Marines and, you know, our Army forces. And, you know, reports of white phosphorus being used and, you know, just the total destruction that was going on in the city.
Now, I read something that you said. You said that you began to feel like the cruel oppressor who had destroyed the lives of these proud people. Was that based on your seeing Iraqis every day who seemed resentful and frightened and angry at your presence?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. Because when I look there and, you know, and see, you know, the eyes of these people and they, you know, and they look at me like it's sort of, you know, kind of like how, you know, the French would look at the, you know, the Nazi Germany or like any of the people that were overrun by the Romans or things like that. Then it makes me wonder, you know, just what exactly does this flag on my shoulder mean, you know, because we're supposed to be the symbol of freedom and hope. So, you know, you would expect everywhere, you know, in most places where you went, except for, you know, your enemies, that, you know, they would be glad to see you. And when they didn't do that, you know, you start, you know, feeling really bad. And then, you know, coupled that with, you know, the things I started to realize that, you know, I felt like, okay, we made a, you know, really major mistake, you know, because I don't want to be, you know, part of something that that is the very opposite of the ideals that we were taught since we were little.
So you kept doing research, digging up more information that was different from what you were getting from the military and the American media. And you say this went on for a couple of years?
Yes, correct. We redeployed back in Qadirbagh Emory Airfield in 2005. And then I got myself a computer and got connected to the Internet, because for me, the Internet is the world's largest library. And, you know, when you're in a foreign country, it's very difficult to find an English language library. So that was, you know, the main source for me to basically have a window into the world and see what's going on. I started digging through, you know, so many, like, different pieces and news stories and everything, and started finding out, you know, basically all the major lies that were told by, you know, the Bush administration. You know, take, for example, the Downing Street memo that, you know, was released by the British government, you know, talking about, you know, how the Bush administration already prepared for this war, you know, a year in advance before, you know, anybody even resolved the issue of the weapons of mass destruction. Talked about how the CIA officially reported that there were no WMDs found, and then, you know, watching the video where George Bush was making a joke out of it while the people in Iraq are suffering and dying, he's sitting there making a joke out of it, trying to find weapons of mass destruction on the stage. And, I mean, stuff like this is just totally uncalled for. And then I was also looking, you know, trying to look through the laws and everything, you know, the, like U.S. law and even international law, because I was reading reports about, you know, this war being condemned internationally. And what I found was, like, you know, highly disturbing, because there is no formal declaration of war, you know, that was, you know, set forth by Congress. There wasn't one. So by U.S. Constitution standards, that this war is, like, completely illegal as far as, you know, and also a myriad of other things. And, you know, going through the, you know, Geneva Conventions, going through, you know, the U.N., you know, what happened at the U.N. and everything, and about how Germany ruled in 2005 that, you know, the war was illegal, you know, and that's like, you know, that says a lot when a major Western power, you know, sits there and, you know, rules that, you know, the conflict that you're in is illegal.
All of this research, plus what sounds like a very troubled conscience, led you to make a very crucial decision. Tell us about that decision.
You're absolutely correct with the troubled conscience, because once I pretty much figured out the truth that this war was basically nothing but a fraud on not only the American people but the entire world, that I resolved within myself that I would no longer, you know, go on another deployment to Iraq. In that time, there's a 2-year period. There was about a 2-year period of total reorganization, so that gave me time to think. So the major decision did not come up until about January of 2007, when we got the warning order that our deployment, we would be scheduled to deploy in the summer of last year. At the time, I was told, because there was such, you know, an excessive, there was actually a problem with too many people in our unit, so they had to make a decision to, you know, leave some people behind and then send the rest on. Then I was one of the guys that was picked to stay behind, so I thought everything was okay. 4 months later, they informed me that that they would possibly need every single mechanic, because there might be an additional mission in, you know, in addition to the one that they were given, and that, you know, because of that, I would have to deploy to Iraq. This was, at this point, this was the moment of truth. I had to, you know, make a really big decision as to, you know, whether or not to go ahead, you know, in spite of my conscience and, you know, be a good soldier, or would I have to basically say, no, I can't do this because, you know, it's just, you know, totally cruel and I don't want to have an indirect hand in, you know, any more atrocities that are going on in Iraq. I talked to one of my NCOs about it privately, and he mentioned about conscientious objection. The problem with conscientious objection, though, is that unlike most other countries, America has it in their regulations that you have to be against every single war ever fought. It doesn't matter if it's an offensive war, a defensive war, it doesn't matter. You have to be against every single war. For me, that is just a virtual impossibility, because if, you know, they're overrunning America's shores, of course I'm going to pick up a weapon and help to defend it. So that argument right there would throw the conscientious objection thing right out of the window. Also, at the same time, I was also, you know, doing research on, like, other soldiers that, like, you know, were conscientious objectors. And the case of Augustine Aguayo popped up, and that one was just crazy about, you know, how, you know, the military treated him when he didn't want to fight any wars, period. I mean, the guy went down there without a weapon, you know. I mean, he went with a weapon, but he didn't load it or anything, you know, and he was a combat medic. I mean, so he would have been under fire regardless, but still he refused to, you know, fire a weapon. He didn't want to hurt anybody. And the military still wanted to force him down, you know, a second time to Iraq, you know, in handcuffs, you know, just because they didn't believe that he was a true conscientious objector. So that right there told me right then and there that is not the way to go. That basically left me with two options. It's either go to Iraq anyway, or I would have to basically walk away from the service, because there's no other option you have. It's either CO status, AWOL, or just, you know, do as you're told. So on April 11th, I went on leave, you know, so I could talk to my family and everything, but I didn't go there. I ended up going to southern Germany because I set up a lot of good contacts with everybody in the time that, you know, we didn't deploy, because I traveled a lot in Germany, so I had a lot of good contacts, and we discussed the issue. And I made a decision within that two-week period that I would have to walk away from the service rather than, you know, either get myself killed or get somebody else killed, you know, on a war that was based on a pack of lies.
And you went AWOL then?
Yes, I did.
How long did you remain AWOL?
I was AWOL officially from April 20th, 2007 until just last week, actually.
And tell us what you did just last week.
Just last week, after exhausting every other option I possibly could to normally immigrate into Germany, and there was trying to find a way to, you know, get a U.S. passport so I can at least go back to America and see, you know, what other options are there, because it just wasn't possible because of my status, I decided to try for asylum. This idea came up 1 year ago because I was in contact with the military counseling network, and they actually brought that up as one of the options, but I wanted to wait to do that because I wanted to make that the absolutely last possible thing, because I knew that going for asylum in a country that has a significant amount of U.S. soldiers would not be an easy task. And, I mean, but at the same time, you know, Germany is, like I said, a staunch opponent, you know, of the Iraq War. So it's it was pretty much a toss-up. But the other thing, too, was that once I applied for asylum, that would send a red flag to the U.S. military, and they would, you know, they would know who I was, you know, and everything. If it failed, then I would have to turn myself in, you know, to the military authorities.
So did you contact the German government then and file an official request for asylum?
Yes, that is true. I did that last Wednesday.
And the basis for this request is that you don't want to be sent to fight in an illegal war.
That is correct.
Tell me what your supporters in Germany think of your chances of getting asylum.
It's a wide range, actually. I've heard some people say that, you know, it's 50-50, it could go either way, and some people have gone as low as, like, 10% because of, you know, the political aspect of it, not because of the law aspect. If I was from any other country, most likely I would get it because the war is sanctioned illegally by a myriad of countries, and the fact that the EU has changed the laws in the last couple of years saying that soldiers that, you know, are forced to commit, you know, participate in a war that, you know, committed war crimes or anything like, or anything in that manner, you know, they're allowed to, you know, seek asylum.
So you took a great risk in doing this.
Yes.
And it seems like there can be negative consequences either way. If you don't get asylum, the army has you again and can court-martial you for going AWOL. And if you do get it, you can't go back to the States. Is that right?
That is a possibility. If I lose, I definitely most likely would have to go to, you know, go to military court. If I do get it, from what Dr. Marks has said, spoken to me, he's my attorney, he said that I don't have to lose my citizenship, but I'm quite sure the United States would reserve the right to revoke my citizenship based on my actions.
Tell me about your family. How do they feel about all this?
I didn't keep a lot of contact with my family in the last year and a half while I was AWOL because I wanted to protect them, you know, with the passage of the Patriot Act and everything, and with, you know, the big controversy with wiretapping and everything. I did not want my parents to get in any trouble for, you know, possibly, like, harboring a fugitive or staying in contact with a fugitive or anything like that. I got in contact with them, though, in the last couple of days and explained the situation to them. They're very worried, you know, as to what could possibly happen to me. However, they are supportive of me because they understand the situation and they see that I actually took a stand against, you know, the things that are going on.
Now, right now, the Army can't get its hands on you because you're protected by your legal status as an asylum seeker. Is that right?
That is correct. Under the Geneva Conventions, hopefully they will honor that.
Tell me how long you expect the entire process to take. How long before a decision comes down?
Well, given the difficulty of the entire issue, it could go anywhere from 3 months to, from what Dr. Marks has said, to around 5 years. Because there are there's like many appeals processes that we can go through.
Do you have lots of support in Germany? Are there people helping you with your legal expenses and your living expenses?
Yes, I have like quite a bit of support, actually. Right now, my biggest supporters are the Military Counseling Network. They're based in Bommental, Germany. Connection AFAL, which is in Frankfurt. And the other one that I want to give a shout-out to is the Iraq Veterans Against the War, which I have been a proud member of for the last couple of months.
So you seem to have substantial backing for the position you're taking.
Oh, yes. After reading, after finding out that my face was blasted around the world, I was reading, like, a lot of comments and everything, and there's quite a big groundswell of support, you know, just from, like, everyday people, which I really appreciate and everything. It's just unbelievable that, you know, I'm really happy that so many people, you know, see, you know, what's really happening, you know, on the geopolitical stage and, you know, are willing to, you know, come forward and, like, you know, give their two cents on the matter.
Well, add courage to resist to your list of supporters, Andre. Your written story is up on our website, and soon this interview will be up there as well. We're pleased and excited to be able to spread the word about this brave and principled action that you're taking. This is something that could turn out to help other GIs, too, who feel the same way you do about the war in Iraq. So you're doing something courageous and important, and we applaud you for doing it.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, because I want to add something to that, too, what you just said. I really hope that, you know, I hope the guys that, you know, are also living on the ground, you know, around the world are listening and everything, that that we're all in this together, you know, even if we can't contact each other or whatever, we're all in this together, and that, you know, hopefully, you know, if I succeed in this matter, yeah, it would be like, you know, an unbelievable precedent. It should send a strong message to the military, you know, not to the military, but to Washington, because this is not about the military. The military, I think, is a good organization. It's just that they have to take their orders from, you know, the people that are sitting in Washington, and they're the ones that made the mistake, not the military.
Thank you so much for talking with us today, Andre. We're going to keep following your case and doing what we can to be supportive.
All right. Thank you very much.